Luke 7:1-7:10, the 32nd talk in a series on the Gospel of Luke, was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 1, 2005 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
Than it is in Luke's account, he doesn't need those details in order to convey the meaning, significance, and value of Jesus' actions. And for that reason, for the efficiency and economy of paring down his account, he just omits those details. Now, in case you didn't catch it, in the Luke account, Luke tells the story, let me do it the other way. Matthew tells the story as a centurion coming to Jesus, asking him to heal his servant, Jesus agreeing to do so, beginning to come, and the centurion, or actually I don't remember in Matthew whether he begins to come or not, but either immediately or as he begins to come, the centurion says, well, actually, you don't need to come into my house. All you need to do is speak the word, and the servant will be healed. And Jesus says, wow. I haven't seen faith like this even in Israel, and then makes a comment about Gentiles being included in the kingdom of heaven, and then says, he's healed. Just as you've asked, he's healed. Well, that's Matthew's account. Now, if I didn't know anything else, there's no way in the world that I wouldn't know that the centurion and Jesus were having a face-to-face conversation in Matthew. That's the way it reads. That's what you would think is going on. You go to Luke and you find out, actually, Luke tells the account somewhat differently. The centurion never come into face-to-face contact, according to Luke. A centurion sends some Jewish elders who, on his behalf, ask Jesus if he won't come to the centurion's home and heal his servant. And the elders vouch for this guy as a man who's worthy of this. Jesus agrees to do so and is heading back, and now some friends of the centurion have been sent by the centurion on his behalf, and they intersect them and say, you know, actually, you don't need to come to my house. I know what it's like to be under authority. Just say the word, and he'll be healed. And Jesus comments that he's never seen any faith like this in Israel, and says, so be it, it's as you've said, and they determine in retrospect that the time at which the servant was healed must have been exactly the time at which Jesus said that. Okay, well, that's different. In Matthew, you would think they were having a face-to-face conversation. In Luke, you know that they never had a face-to-face conversation. It was all carried on through intermediaries. Well, is one of the accounts wrong? No. It would be silly to call one of the accounts in error on that account because, namely, Matthew's account in error, I think, because it's very, very much a part of our way of relating stories to one another that we only give the degree of detail and therefore the precision in the account that's appropriate to our purposes. And Matthew has deemed it unnecessary to give the rather complex picture of a conversation going on through intermediaries, because for the purposes of Matthew in conveying the meaning and significance and value of what Jesus did, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether they had a face-to-face encounter or not. So he simply imprecisely tells the story, leaving out some of these significant details. We do the same thing at least in all the TV shows, when somebody says, the White House called, A, they don't mean the House called, and secondly, they don't mean the President called necessarily. It's someone who has been designated with authority by the President, delegated the authority by the President to speak on his behalf. Well, that's what's going on in the way that Matthew is using his language. The centurion has delegated people to speak on his behalf, and they are speaking on his behalf. So even though it's not a face-to-face encounter, when Matthew says that the centurion asked him, well, that's exactly what happened. The centurion asked him. Did he ask him in direct encounter or through intermediaries? Well, through intermediaries, but so? Who cares? And I think that's the way to understand that. But that leads us to some important observations about the nature of the doctrine of inerrancy and how we are to deal with parallel accounts. The first one I've already talked about, but biblical inerrancy is not an assertion that the Bible is always precise. That's not what we're asserting, nor should we be asserting. It's not always precise in its description of events. It's only an assertion that it is always faithful to truthfully convey what occurred within the limits of precision that the author intended. So we're not claiming precision for the Bible, we're only claiming faithfulness for the Bible. And that's all we need to support its authority. A second point is we need to be clear on what we would mean by an error when we deny that there are any errors in the Bible. Specifically, an error needs to be defined with respect to what the author of the language of the text did and did not in fact intend. And that, of course, is inextricably linked to what level of precision they intended to be using in describing the event. So, what that means is, biblical inerrancy does not mean that we will never be misled with respect to the precise historical details of a particular event. We might be. We may picture something happening that would not match a video recording of what actually went on there. That's true. That may be the case. But it is a guarantee that we will not be misled with respect to the spiritual, philosophical, or theological import of the event. Because in the end, that's what we care about. That's why these Gospels are being written. They're not being written to satisfy my detailed curiosity of exactly how events went down. They're being written in order to convey to us the spiritual, philosophical, and theological import of this man in his life. And as long as it faithfully conveys that, that's we are getting the message of the biblical writers. So that is to say, the account is rendered in such a way that we will not fail to see the import of the event with respect to its implications for our understanding of the truth of the biblical worldview, the gospel, and the faith. If we are interested, for whatever reasons, in reconstructing as precise an account of what occurred as we possibly can, then it's incumbent upon us to combine or synthesize all the parallel accounts on the assumption that they will all be equally true and without error to the level of precision that they were written in. And even that is no guarantee, because we have no guarantee that all of the authors did not take one shortcut or another. Leave out some details, leave out some level of precision. So, that's on an aside, but this is a very popular passage that's used to disprove biblical authority and biblical inerrancy, and so I wanted to comment on that. Well, let's look at the event itself, and Luke has a more detailed and more precise account where we're doing all this through intermediaries. It begins by saying he completed his discourse, he goes to Capernaum. A centurion slave, who was highly regarded by the centurion, the slave that was highly regarded by the centurion, was sick and about to die. When he heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders asking him to come and save the life of the slave. Okay. He's called a centurion here. What's a little bit puzzling would be, what sort of centurion is he? If he's a Roman centurion, why is a Roman centurion in Galilee? Because Galilee at this point in time is not, strictly speaking, a Roman province. It's run by Herod, who is king of the of this particular tetrarch, what's called a tetrarchy. So it may very well be that Herod simply has an army of his own that he's modeled and formed and shaped to copy and to emulate the Roman model, and so that he has centurions in his army, just as the Romans have centurions in their army. So he may not be a Roman centurion. But I don't think there's any way to read the account without acknowledging that he must be a Gentile, because I think that's what makes the best sense out of this account, is that he's in fact a Gentile. So I don't know who this guy is. I suppose he could be a Roman who's actually serving under Herod, perhaps, as a mercenary. Maybe Rome has loaned some of their army to Herod and kind of put them under Herod. I don't know how to put all this together, but he may or may not be a Roman. In any case, he's serving in a certain rank in the army that is serving Herod. He's a wealthy man. Don't know what to make of that exactly, because centurions, by virtue of the fact that they're centurions, would not necessarily be wealthy. Centurion was a relatively low rank, wouldn't necessarily have risen up through the ranks and become wealthy in the process. So if he's wealthy, it's probably not because he's a centurion, it's probably because he has some other independent source of wealth. He undoubtedly is what we call a Gentile God-fearer. And I think I've mentioned this before, but in the Roman world, paganism was really beginning to crumble of its own foolishness and absurdity. And the intellectuals in the Roman culture were gravitating more toward what we call Hellenistic religions, or Hellenistic religions and Hellenistic philosophy, which were a lot more intellectually satisfying than the old polytheism and paganism that they were accustomed to. And certainly with respect to morality, the moral tenor of the empire was being degraded considerably. And anyone who had any sort of moral sensibility at all would have found Judaism to be very interesting and very attractive by comparison. So you had a number of Gentiles who would gravitate to the Jewish synagogue to simply watch, listen, hear, and observe. And over the course of time, as they would listen to the synagogue services, they'd become very well educated in Torah. And they understood what the prophets taught and what the law was, what the Mosaic covenant was, the history of Abraham, the history of the Jewish people, the promises that God made to the Jewish people, and so forth. And they became fairly savvy in what we call the Old Testament history and scriptures. But for whatever reasons, they didn't actually proselytize. To proselytize, you would have to, as a male, you'd have to be circumcised, you'd have to be baptized, you have to offer a particular offering, and then you'd have to agree to abide by all the provisions of the Mosaic covenant as interpreted by the rabbis. And that was a pretty overwhelming decision for a Gentile to make. I mean, they're literally having to forsake everything in their Gentile culture and adopt an entirely new culture. And that was a step that these God-fearers were not somehow able and willing to make. But the truth and the moral vision that was embodied in Judaism made a lot of sense to them, was very intriguing to them. So they kind of had one foot in Judaism and one foot in their own native culture, and they just sort of straddled the division between them. That appears to be what this centurion is. He's a God-fearer. He was so committed to the truth of Judaism that he had, out of his own resources, built them a synagogue in Capernaum. I mean, he had personally financed the synagogue. It describes the people that he sent to Jesus were called the Jewish elders. Elders were a class of people, an office. A class of people in the Jewish synagogue. They were people who held various offices. There was what they called, I think it's the head. Yeah, the head of the synagogue was like the presiding officer. And then there were, I think, two other officers who had kind of permanent roles in the synagogue. And the group of them together were called the elders of the synagogue. So it's apparently these men who had a vested interest in the synagogue and in the life of the Jewish community in Capernaum, who this centurion sent to Jesus to appeal on his behalf to have Jesus come and heal his servant. That's interesting in its own right, that this centurion would be this interested, this invested in a mere servant. I think it speaks volumes about the character and the morality of the man that he would have that kind of regard for his, literally a slave. Okay, well that's the picture. The elders come to Jesus and they actually appeal to Jesus by commending this man, saying, "This is a great man. This man is worthy of your attention. He loves our nation. He loves our nation, and it was he who built us our synagogue." So Jesus responds positively, and he starts to go toward this man's home. When he's not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself further, for I am not worthy for you to come under my roof." Now, what's going on here? Why does he think it would be troubling him? Why does he say, "I'm not worthy for you to come under my roof"? I can't prove this. It's not the only way to take this, but what makes the most sense to me is because he's a Gentile. And according to rabbinic tradition, a Jew could not enter the home of a Gentile without becoming defiled. And it becomes a colossal hassle for a Jew to be defiled by his contact with a Gentile. I mean, you got offerings you got to do and ablutions you got to do and staying away from the temple for a while. And I don't remember what all the details of that are, but you need to become once again appropriately cleansed before you can join in full standing in the service and the worship of the Jews if you've been defiled by your contact with Gentiles. So he's a God-fearer. He knows the rules. He knows the commandments. He knows the laws. He knows how the rabbis interpret those laws. He knows that he really would be troubling Jesus a great deal for him to actually enter into his home in order to heal the servant, because he's going to become unclean. So out of consideration for Jesus, he says, "You know, Jesus, I know what's going on here. I know how this works. There actually is a way for you to do this without getting defiled. You don't have to come into my home and get defiled. Just speak the word, and my servant will be healed." And he says he understands that because, he says, "For this reason I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you, but just," yeah, the reason he sent intermediaries and didn't come directly is because the contact with him would have defiled Jesus. So he didn't come to him directly for the same reason. "But just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man placed under authority, with soldiers under me, and I say to this one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my slave, 'Do this,' and he does it." So he gives an analogy with respect to his own life. The reason he knows that Jesus doesn't need to come into the house is because as a person under authority, he understands how authority works. Authority works in such a way that the one with authority doesn't have to do the deed. He only has to will the deed. He only has to command the deed, if you will. And so what he's arguing is, I've been watching. When you do miracles, you're not doing the miracles. You're simply willing the miracles. You're simply deciding, making a decision, choosing within your own mind and will and heart that you want something done, and something else does it. Somebody else is doing it. And he realizes also, because he says, "I am a man," he starts by saying, "I'm a man under authority." I'm a man having authority, but I'm a man under authority. He also recognizes that when you do what you do, you're not doing it because you're doing it. You're doing it because someone above you has commanded it, has instructed it, has allowed it, has somehow out of their authority said this is what's going to happen. So you, Jesus, are just simply somebody like me under authority who gets instructions or gets delegated authority, and then you use that authority by commanding something else, and it's something else that gets the job done. So since that's the way it works, you don't need to be there. You don't need to come into my house. And that's what Jesus responds to and says, wow. Wow. I haven't even met a Jew who understands that. This is incredible. This Gentile understands who I am in a way that no one in Israel has understood who I am. We'll come to that in a second. But I think what he means is no Jew has understood that I simply am what I am by the authority of my Father, and I do what I do out of the command of my will. Nobody in Israel has understood that, but this man has got it. And then he responds accordingly by saying, okay, then let it be done. I command it be done. And as we find out,
it had the effect that the centurion thought it would have. The slave is healed just at the decision, the will, the choice of Jesus.
Okay. Let's look at this passage now. I look at its implications for a couple of things. The first one is, how are we to understand who this Jesus is, the Christ? Well, this passage tells us a lot, I think, about that. First of all, the obvious thing is, it tells us that whatever it means to be the Christ, Jesus is a man under the authority of God the Father. So whatever authority he has is derived from God. It's not authority that he has in and of himself. And that's what the centurion recognized. It's also helpful to recognize, as the centurion did, that Jesus doesn't do the miracles he does. That's the part I had not ever clarified for myself. Jesus doesn't do the healing of the slave. Jesus doesn't do the healing of blind people. Jesus doesn't do the healing of lame people or the raising people from the dead. He doesn't do nothing. He simply uses authority that's been delegated to him to let it be so, to say, let it be so, to command, let it be so. What is it that does the healing? Well, I think there's probably two ways to look at it, and it may depend on the miracle, which is the better way to look at it. Jesus is commanding the elements of nature. It's physics that does it, chemistry that does it, biology that does it, subject to the command of Jesus. Jesus doesn't have any power that is not already somehow resident in nature as God has created it, and as God, his Father, is controlling it. So another way of looking at it is, it's not Jesus who's doing the miracle, it's God who's doing the miracle, the Creator. It's the Creator who is using whatever resources he needs to, if not simply creating ex nihilo, just creating out of nothing, to do what needs to be done. But the centurion was right. The apt analogy is, when a centurion speaks, it's the soldiers under him and his servants and slaves who do whatever he wants done. He never dirties his hands. They go do it. He only commands. Well, Jesus doesn't do the miracles. He only commands, and whoever the counterpart to the slaves and servants and soldiers under him are, whatever the counterpart is, that's what does it. Okay, so as the Christ, he has authority delegated to him from God, and he commands rather than does. That still leaves the question, okay, he commands and wills the miracles rather than does the miracles, but still, how are we to understand the relationship between Jesus' will, Jesus' decision, Jesus' choice, and God's will? Two different answers we could give to that. One would be that there's no meaningful distinction between Jesus' human will and the divine will. We talked about this a little bit earlier with respect to the account about the fish. But one possibility is Jesus just goes through life and he chooses what he wants. He decides what he wants. He, at his own discretion, he decides, I'll heal this person, I'll heal this person, I'll do this miracle here, I'll do this sign here, I'll do this sign here. And when Jesus decides to do what he decides to do, it is one and the same thing as God deciding to do what he wants to do. Because God has so completely mapped his will onto the human will of Jesus that when Jesus does whatever he humanly wants to do, then that just is God doing what he divinely wants to do. Well, the problem with that possibility is Jesus wouldn't be human then. Not really. That would make Jesus, the Christ, God in human form. And I know in our somewhat imprecise and sloppy use of language, we often describe Jesus as God in human form, but strictly speaking, that's not the case. He's not God in human form in the way the Egyptians thought that Pharaoh was God in human form, or the king of Babylon was Marduk in human form. That's not what the Christ is. That's not God having embodied himself in a human being, and he just is God in human form, because that's not really being a human being. God in human form is God in human form. It's not a human being. But I think we are to understand from the evidence of the New Testament that Jesus was a human being. He's a human individual who is God. So that's the distinction. Jesus is a human individual who is God in some significant, meaningful, and unique sense. He's not God in human form. It seems to me that it's a fundamental element of being a human being that we confront the obligation to submit my will to the will of God. That's part of what it means to be a human being. I have to have a will that in theory, that in principle, might be in conflict with the divine will. And part of my obligation as a human being is to make the decision, do I want to subject my will, make my will, subsume my will, make my will subservient to the will of God, or do I want to go my own way? And that's part and parcel of the essence of what it means to be a human being. So if Jesus is a human being, then we have to understand that in principle, there's the possibility of a conflict between the will of Jesus and the will of God, and the glory of Jesus' life is how gracefully he was able always to say, not my will, but your will be done. I actually would rather go another way, frankly, but on the other hand, I have an obligation here that I am delighted to keep. I want my will not to be done. I want your will to be done. That's his humanity acting in the way that human beings were intended from the beginning to act. So there is a meaningful distinction between Jesus' human will and the divine will. And therefore, Jesus' will is the will of God only to the extent to which Jesus subjects his will to the will of God. That's what it means for him to be the Christ, I think. Now, Jesus is said to be under authority by the centurion. Seems to me there's three ways to understand that, and we have to decide that as well. One possibility would be that Jesus is being under authority means that God gives Jesus strict, detailed instructions that he reveals to him about what he wants to do, and then Jesus just obeys it. You tell me what to do, and I'll do it. The other possibility would be that being under God's authority means that God delegates to him the authority to use his discretion. That's an explicit delegation, however. That's why, because we're seeing Jesus as a human being, we're seeing Jesus with a distinct will of his own, but God is simply saying, I give you free rein. You decide what trick you want to perform, and I'll do it. I'll make sure it happens. That would be the other possibility. The third possibility would be that one or the other of those is the case in any given circumstance. So that Jesus either strictly obeys the detailed instructions that God somehow reveals to him, or he exercises his own discretion at the explicitly revealed permission of God, or to some extent, with respect to some details, he follows the explicitly revealed instructions of God, and to some extent, he uses his own discretion. So it seems like those are the three options. It seems to me that the evidence suggests the last one, that there's a little bit of variety here, a little bit of variation here, that at some times and some places, God grants Jesus some latitude and some discretion and just simply honors whatever it is that he wants him to do. And that other places, God is giving him some detailed and explicit and direct instructions about here's how this is going to go down. Do this. The reason I say that is because there is the occasional passage where it'll say something like, and Jesus, having compassion on the man or on the woman, healed her or did this or did that. Well, why does Jesus having compassion on the person, why is that at all relevant if the only way he can do a miracle is to wait for God to say, do this, and he has to do that? The fact that the biblical author says compassion or mercy or pity had something to do with it suggests that it's a motive working on the will and therefore ultimately the discretion of Jesus himself. So how are we going to make sense out of those kinds of claims unless, at least in those circumstances, Jesus is being granted some kind of discretion? On the other hand, we know he doesn't have full discretion because we saw a passage earlier in Luke where Luke explicitly says, and the Spirit of the Lord was not present for Jesus to perform miracles. That is, that God just wasn't interested in having miracles performed. And when God is not interested, Jesus is powerless. There's nothing Jesus can do if God isn't going to do it, because Jesus doesn't ever do any of it. He only wills it and commands it. So it seems to me that it's that last account. Well, this one last consideration, this, it seems to me, has very important implications for the theology that you might call sacramentalism. There's a whole tradition in Christian history of what's called sacramentalism, where people believe that there are these things called the sacraments, and usually it's, for most Protestants, it would be the Lord's Supper, or what Catholics call the Eucharist, and baptism. The Catholics have other sacraments like marriage and what do they call it now? It used to be extreme unction, but not last rites, whatever it is. When somebody's about to die and you do something. And what else? I'm forgetting one. But different traditions have different sacraments. But what they all share one thing in common, and that is through these physical acts or this physical material, the grace of God is mediated to me through that which is physical. Well, this is a powerful passage to speak to that issue, because here we have this stupid, ignorant, foolish Gentile who doesn't have know nothing about what he's overheard in the synagogues, coming to Jesus and say, I get you. I understand how this works. You don't do anything. You don't need to be there to heal the servant. There's no energy that comes out of your fingertips. There's no power that comes out of your mouth. You're not an X-man. You don't have some supernatural power that allows you to do what you do. This isn't some kind of extra level physics that you have mastered. You're just simply someone who is under authority, and God, who's the one who can do all and accomplish all and bring anything into being, does what you will, what you command. at the appropriate time, in the appropriate way, under the authority delegated to you. That's how that happens. You don't need the physical to mediate grace. You don't need the physical to mediate the power of God. God can do anything he wants, any time he wants, with or without any means he wants. So he doesn't need stuff. And Jesus' perspective on that was a response of, wow, you get it. Wow, you understand. Well, oftentimes sacramentalism is proposed to us as the higher ground, as the superior perspective, as the perspective that really understands the incarnation. Because just as God revealed himself in human form in Jesus, so the grace of God reveals itself in the physical bread or the physical wine or the physical water of the baptism or the physical physical element of the oil when you're anointed in your last rites or whatever, that there's something very godlike about God incarnating his grace and his power into physical and material things. And we non-sacramentalists, we're just ignorant and we really don't get it because we don't understand the incarnational purposes of God. Well, that's not the perspective that Jesus is taking here. He doesn't respond to the centurion and saying, boy, you don't get the incarnation, do you? You don't really understand how devoted and committed God is to making his grace and his spiritual power and authority in fleshed and material world so that the material world can be the window onto the spiritual world, and so that it's only through the material that we can have God's grace mediated to us. He doesn't give him that kind of answer. Instead, he says, yeah, you understand God, don't you? You really get it. You really understand that God is not limited by any sort of arbitrary theological constrictions that we might make up for him, some theological hoop that we make for God to jump through. That's not what's going on. God just does what he does. Okay, I think that's enough for this morning. Your comments, your questions, your objections, your criticisms.
Jack, it seems to me that this is a great illustration, too, of faith, in the sense that it's not how much faith the centurion had, but it's this reality or this truth that he became to be persuaded of. And that is an illustration of this, that this issue of authority and his relationship with those who he's above, and then Jesus' relationship with God.
Right, exactly. We could have gone to another passage. I forgot.
But it just illustrates that it's not this issue of degrees or how much I believe it or
right.
This intensity or whatever.
Exactly.
But it's this truth.
And I think that's the key word, intensity. I mean,
yes.
The view that I grew up with is that faith is like this state of consciousness that I get myself into. I mean, there's believing and then there's really believing with an intensity. And what gives power to my faith, and I really can conceive of it as a power that's really deriving from my faith. The power is not from God. The power is from the intensity of my loyal, undoubting commitment to the truth of this thing. But it's really sort of the state of consciousness of it that is giving the intensity to it, which is giving the power to it, which is making it effective. And I think in the charismatic movement, that tends to be the concept of faith that's out there. I think among Protestants in general, that's the concept of faith that we kind of absorb from our culture. And it's exactly not what's going on here. What the centurion has is not sort of a intensity of state of consciousness. He just gets it. He just knows who Jesus is. And he recognizes that God is the one with the power. It's not my faith that has power. It's not even Jesus' faith that has power. It's God who has power. And you either know that or you don't know that. But if you do know that, you know that God can act when he wants to, and so he's counting on it. He's expecting it. Yeah, that's very much to the point, I think, of the power of this passage.
And relating this to the individual believer who walks in God's story pretty much the same way as Jesus did, has been given authority over spirits. How closely do you think that what we observe in the human Jesus is the believer to walk in when he's totally mature? And how do you think this relates to like a question that a person that I know I'm going to give this tape to asked this question in relation to the subject of prophecy? Does a prophet hear from God and then speak, or does a prophet get an impulse, speak, and God, just by very nature of the prophet acting in his story, he responds, he puts the impulse into the prophet and then affects?
Okay. With respect to your first question, I think much of what we're talking about here is unique to Jesus, or if to the extent that it's not unique to Jesus, is unique to Jesus and his apostles. It makes no sense to me to take the perspective that because we are believers and disciples of Jesus, we ought to be able to heal as Jesus healed. It doesn't make any sense. The only reason Jesus could heal is because God wanted to send the message to the world, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased, listen to him. Listen to what he has to say, because he's the one I've sent into the world to set the record straight on what human existence is all about and what God's purposes are all about. Well, anybody can stand up and make the claim. I could stand up here and make the claim, you didn't know this, but God sent me into the world to give you the last word and the last truth on everything about reality. Well, why would you believe me? You shouldn't. okay, sorry, any doubts about that. But when you have a person coming to the world making that kind of claim and who can do what no one else can do, okay, now at least I have a basis for making a decision, you know what, I should trust him when he says he's the one who's come into the world. Because otherwise, if he's not the one who's come into the world, how's he doing all that stuff that he's doing? And so what we see in the life of Jesus, I think, is unique to him because his role is unique. I am not the Messiah. I am not a prophet. I am not nothing of any significance in that regard in laying out the truth of reality. I'm just a disciple. I'm just one who's come to sit at the feet of Jesus and learn what it is that he came into the world to reveal. So in that regard, I don't think that part of what we're talking about has anything to do with me. What has everything to do with me is him modeling what it means to be a human being, namely to have a will that can either be in obedience to the will of God or in rebellion against the will of God. And Jesus models what it's like to submit my will to the will of God so that my life is always lived in obedience to God's will. And in that regard, that he's exactly the model for me. That's exactly what I should be. And we, of course, falter at that, but at least he's held out the ideal for us. And then your last question was about prophecy. Not being a prophet, I don't know what it's like to receive a prophecy, but you do get some clues and some hints in the Old Testament. One of the prophets talks about, and the oracle of the Lord came to me. Another one says, the burden of the Lord came upon me. Another one says, the word of the Lord came to me. And it's almost like they're picking language, they're coining language to try to capture some kind of subjective experience that they have. Something in their experience is it's discernible to them when God is revealing to them. And we don't know this, but I have to assume that God had to train them over time in their experience empirically to be able to know and discern when the word of by the way, I should add to that, even though they could eventually learn to identify as it a subjective experience, I think it had to be confirmed to them objectively. You know, I would imagine when the Lord first comes to them, he speaks to them in a very distinctive subjective experience, and they, you know, they probably don't know what to do with it, but say, and in some way predicts the future, and then lo and behold, it happens. And then it happens again, and it happens again, and it happens again. And over time, inductively, I think, they learn, as rational human beings do, oh, I get it. When I have that experience, that's God telling me what the future is going to be, and I know it's God because it happens. And they learn to trust that and then become a prophet. I have no evidence for that, but I'm just speculating on how would God make me a prophet if I were to be a prophet? I think, why would I trust a subjective experience just when I have a subjective experience? Unless there's some way that I don't comprehend about how a subjective experience can be self-authenticating, then the only other option is God has to train me through empirical experience to trust that subjective experience.
Fantastic. If you could speak to this a little bit, I was thinking about kind of the elders qualifying the worthiness of the centurion by saying, hey, he agrees with us, therefore he should be blessed by God. And Jesus really didn't kind of respond to that, at least verbally. But then when the centurion kind of agreed with Jesus, it was kind of like Jesus said, well, yeah, you're kind of blessed because, not because you agree with them, but because you get God. Does that make sense?
Repeat that one more time.
The elders were kind of saying, he's worthy because he agrees with us. Uh-huh. Jesus is saying, he's worthy because he agrees with me.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And my question, if that's true...
Although, let me qualify that. It ultimately is not really about worthiness in this passage. I mean, yeah.
Well, because my question is, they use that to motivate, if that's possible, mm-hmm. Jesus to... persuade Jesus, which I find kind of funny to be able to, you know, do that. But why did Jesus go, do you think?
Right.
I mean, and again, that's kind of his will, God's will kind of thing. Did Jesus kind of go, oh, yeah, God's going to do something here? And,
right. You know. Yeah, I mean, in terms of did God say go or is God saying do whatever you want to do, Jesus? I mean, I don't know. But I think ultimately all the miracles – in the end, boiled down to not the worthiness of the recipient of the miracle, but the purposes of God in credentialing Jesus. And, I mean, it is significant. When you go to the Matthew account, Luke leaves it out. But when you go to the Matthew account, Jesus has some very, very important words to say about Gentiles in that thing. They're going to be Gentiles in the kingdom of heaven with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Jews cast out into the outer darkness. I mean, that's a heavy thing for him to say. And so, and probably, I mean, it's certainly the first time in Luke. It may very well have been the first time in Jesus' ministry where he makes an explicit comment that it's possible to be a Gentile and be rightly related to God, and it's possible to be a Jew and not be rightly related to God. You got to figure that out, you guys. And so it may very well have been that this particular occasion was just ripe with the possibilities of driving that point home, and that may be a part of why he did it.
Your intention in the presentation was to connect, to make a connectivity between God, the Creator, and Jesus as he performs his signs. And you begged the question slightly when you said either or for me, for if this particular instance might have been the intention of God the Creator to happen and Christ says, okay, water, you be wine, and he was wrong, that would have been a big mistake. And so I'm looking for a more concrete connection so that Christ is always right, not either or. You alluded to a remark in Luke that the apostle says it wasn't the time or something like that today, and that might be a way of answering my question, but it just is a concern of mine that you tried to answer this connectivity, yet you gave us at least two choices.
And in my answer, how do you see the possibility of Jesus being wrong?
What? Well, if the one way of performing a sign is that God the Creator wanted it to be, and Jesus was going along and did one of those things that God the Creator did not want it to be, it would not have happened. If right. It wasn't God the Creator's intention to make water into wine, and Christ said, become wine, he might have done it incorrectly.
Okay, yeah, that's true. Why do you want to protect him from that? I mean, what I'm saying is I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I think that's part of his humanity, is that as a human being, there's the possibility of him being disobedient. There's the possibility of him being rebellion. And the remarkable thing about Jesus is he never was disobedient. He never was rebellious. But not because he couldn't be rebellious. It's because he wasn't rebellious. As a matter of fact, he never disobeyed, but he was capable of disobedience. See, I think we talked about that a little bit in connection with the temptations. It was possible for him to blow the whole thing there. I mean, that's why he's such a hero. I mean, not only there, but on the cross, going to the cross. It was possible for him to blow the whole thing by saying, this is just too much of you to ask of me, God. I ain't going to do that. But he didn't. At every crucial step in his life, he was always willing to say, not my will, but your will be done. So I may be missing the actual heart of your question, but I don't have a problem with his humanity being so truly humanity that rebellion and disobedience was truly a possibility for Jesus. But he wasn't. He wasn't disobedient and he wasn't rebellious.
And he wasn't in every single circumstance. And therefore, can you make a more concrete connection as to why, like the answer of the prophets, he, Christ, knew the will of his Father at all times? That would be one of my suggested,
yes. Oh, okay.
Suggested
no,
answers.
No, yes, okay, I see what you're saying. Yes, no, I'm arguing he knew at all times the will of the Father. But what was the will of the Father? I'm saying it might have come in two forms. One might have been, look, Jesus, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to bring a school of fish up next to the boat. I want you to instruct Peter to take the boat out there and lower the nets down, and I'm going to fill those nets up with so many fish that I'm going to blow his ever-loving mind. I mean, he might have given him those detailed instructions. And then at other times, when Jesus was moved with compassion, the word of the Lord that came to him, however the will of the Father was revealed to him, might have come in the form of, do whatever you want, Jesus. Do whatever you want here. And so Jesus is literally responding out of his humanity and saying, well, I want to have compassion is what I want to do. And I want to touch their eyes and have sight restored. That's what I want to do. And he basically has the carte blanche permission of the Father, you know, whatever you decide to do here, I'm going to honor that by acting. I'm going to do it. Now, I'm a divine determinist. So in Jesus actually having the desire to heal, where's that coming from except the will of the Father already? So God giving permission to do whatever they want to do is not taking it out of God's hands.
That was a clarifying
okay,
point.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I had two different answers coming from you and really was looking for the connectivity in divine determinism is connectivity.
Okay, why don't you hand it to Abigail? We only have time for one more because I... we're running late, but
okay.
Thank you.
This presentation of Jesus as human is entirely exciting because I've always found it problematic that you can present Jesus as God incarnate and yet still find him to be a viable role model for our own lives. And it makes so much more sense when you look at the temptation of Jesus when Satan offers him all the power of the world. If he's had a taste of it from God, you know, it never makes sense if he is God why he should be tempted by that. And yet this does. What I'm wondering is why modern theologians, or perhaps not modern, have chosen to take it the other route and say that he is God, not a human.
Well, I think that goes way, 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 way back into church history, where it's ultimately the Greeks' fault, where under the spell of Greek philosophy and the metaphysical speculation of Greek philosophy, it became very important to make Jesus not just a human being, but not just a human being who is God, but to make him this incredibly complex, mysterious, eternal, divine being that none of us can understand. And in the end, I think that was a disservice because it doesn't really map onto the biblical account. The biblical account is different. It's telling us a story of this human individual that God created and sent into the world to be him, as Paul puts it, the visible image of the invisible God. And I think that's I think when you get to the bottom of that picture, it's a significantly and radically different picture than the picture painted by thousands of years of Christian orthodoxy. In all of our popular conceptions of Jesus, therefore, we are so afraid of being unorthodox that we shy away from allowing the Bible to speak and create its picture of Jesus. And we turn him into something else. Need to let you go. Sorry I kept you late.